Tom Woods Show, episode 1714.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, the Tom Woods Show.
All you men out there, remember, you get a close, smooth, comfortable shave every time without breaking the bank with the official razor of the Tom Woods Show, Harry's. Get a Harry's trial set delivered to your doorstep by going to harrys.com/woods. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. Delighted to be joined once again by Gerard Casey, who is Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at University College Dublin. He's the author of numerous works of importance, Libertarian Anarchy among them, also Freedom's Progress, A History of Political Thought, which is a massive work, and his brand new one, which we're going to talk about today, After Me Too, Feminism, Patriarchy, Toxic Masculinity, and Sundry Cultural Delights. Professor Casey, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Tom. Good to be back.
I don't know why I call you Professor Casey. I know we're on a first-name basis, but I just have so much respect for you. It's like when Murray Rothbard said to me to call him Murray. My response was, I don't think I can.
Well, I know. I have students, and they take about, you know, I mean, I like, when they're students, I prefer that they're formal, but afterwards, obviously, first names are fine. And then it takes them about 10 or 15 years, even when they explicitly say, call me by my first name. But what I really love, of course, are getting mails from the German-speaking world, because they give me all my titles. I become Professor Dr. Casey, which is brilliant. Now, that's respect.
Yes, that is. All right. Well, I think Pope Pius XI, if I understand this right, had three doctorates. So he would be doctor, His Holiness, doctor. I mean, if you forget it, right, at this point.
Don't leave anyone out, not if you're German.
Let's talk about your book here. There's so many interesting topics, but let's start with the most fundamental one, which involves feminism itself. I've talked about this at least several times. And I have had a guest before whom I put it to this way. And I said, most people, when they talk about feminism, the average person on the street will say, well, of course I'm a feminist. I think women should be treated equally with men, that they should have the same opportunities that men have and whatever. And they're talking like they live on another planet, because virtually nobody disagrees with them on this, to the point where you almost don't even need a word for that anymore. But at the same time, we do have to confront the fact that I think for a lot of people in the general public, that is what they think feminism is. So if you come along and suggest there's something wrong with feminism, they think that means you think women shouldn't get educations or something.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, I call this the feminist two-step. So, of course, yeah, I mean, like, you know, perhaps there are a few Neanderthals out there, but by and large, this is a given. I state explicitly, for example, at the start of my book, that I firmly believe that there should be no legal impediments or legal discrimination against women. And that is accepted by pretty much everybody. But that's not the point. The point is that when the feminists are selling feminism, if you object, then that's what they put to you, and you look like an idiot. Right? But of course, what they're actually selling is something quite different, which is some idea of the patriarchy, some idea that women are universally oppressed, some idea that women need special privileges in order to level the playing field, and so on. And that's quite a different story.
Now, there are, it's true, different kinds of feminism, and you talk about that right at the beginning. But I think the points you just raised are shared in common with, if not all of them, then enough for us to be able to generalize that, yeah, of course, that is what they share in common, that women are oppressed, or there's a patriarchy that's in some ways openly, in some ways more surreptitious, trying to harm women. I think they do, by and large, believe this. And generally, I think most of them do believe in a gender pay gap, which I think is preposterous. It's just nothing to this at all. Covered that a few times also. But can we skip ahead, actually, to talk about the patriarchy, because there's a book. Did you ever read the book, The Inevitability of Patriarchy?
No, but I've heard of it, but I haven't actually read it.
Okay, yeah. It's basically a study of societies around the world showing they've all been patriarchies. And then, but then every once in a while you'll say, oh, but in the Amazon, they had, you know, somebody will raise the There's some tribe that nobody's ever heard of, and they're run by. But then when you look closely at those wind up actually being patriarchies also. You know, so even the exceptions are not really exceptions. So anyway, but that's just an interesting fact. That's an empirical fact. Doesn't mean anything about what's right or wrong. But today, what exactly is meant, do you think, by the term patriarchy when it's used in feminist discourse, if I may use a word that left-wing academics like?
Well, once again, you know, sometimes one of the problems that I always encounter and many people encounter is trying to get your interlocutor to actually define terms and to stay with them. So the patriarchy for some feminists, for some advanced feminists, is some kind of mysterious sort of ahuman force which exists, whose sole function, if you like, is to oppress women. A slightly more reasonable but still indefensible position is to say that the patriarchy is some kind of social and political system erected by men to produce and sustain a social and political system that favors men at the expense of women. And that's the one I'm working with. If it doesn't mean that, I don't know what they're talking about.
Now, you go through in your chapter on the patriarchy a few of the kinds of things that people who belong to the so-called men's rights movement have pointed out. That, yes, I can think of things that we might say that would be accurate involving different ways men and women experience life in which, you know, I could think of ways in which women get the short end of the stick. But by and large, the statistics generally run all in the other direction, whether it's college attendance or dying at work or whatever it is, all the things that you would most want, women tend to dominate. The things that you would most want to avoid, men tend to dominate.
Well, yes. As somebody sardonically remarked, when it comes to equality in employment, for example, there doesn't seem to be any mad rush by our feminist friends for the really nasty jobs that are carried out almost exclusively by men, working in mines, in oil tankers, and on the sea, and so on and so forth. It's quite extraordinary. I mean, it's an amazing feat if you think about it. If you look at it sort of disinterestedly, it's an amazing feat of propaganda that, in the face of the evidence, which just points inexorably in the other direction, that in almost every other area, in education, in health, in how they got the franchise, in criminal justice sentencing, in even in relation to domestic abuse, all of these things, women actually are preferentially treated. There is a discrimination between how men and women are treated, and women are treated in general. You can always find specific instances the other way, but women in general are actually treated better than men. It's quite amazing.
I'll definitely have some related episodes listed on the show notes page where we can go into more depth, because in your book, you're covering so many things. I don't want to spend too much time on any one thing, but some of these things like the gender pay gap and some of these statistics and stuff, I'll have episodes related to that linked at tomwoods.com/1714. I have to admit, I skipped ahead a little bit when I was reading this. I wanted to go right to the toxic masculinity section because we hear so much about this. And as with so many academic fads, it's extremely imprecise. I'm not exactly sure what it's supposed to mean or what it refers to. Or is it really just a blanket term to refer to things that irritate particular people? But I think the emotional repression thing is one, but that men supposedly don't show emotions. But even if that were true, and it certainly is not, but even if it were true, it mainly applies, as you say, to, let's say, feelings of fear and sorrow, that men don't cry in public as much because they've been told by their gruff fathers that boys don't cry and stuff like that. Okay. But even that doesn't really affect other people. You know, that's not, I don't see what would be toxic about that. That's unfortunate maybe, but that doesn't affect other people. So something else is motivating this. What really is toxic about so-called toxic masculinity?
Well, once again, I mean, I'm probably the wrong person to ask about this because I don't know. And again, it seems to be a sort of blanket condemnation, and very often toxic masculinity seems to be more or less masculinity when you actually push, the button. In other words, it seems that just being a man is in itself problematic. And this accusation of emotional repression has always baffled and indeed irritated me, because as I point out in the book, men laugh, at jokes. They exult in victory. They sing loudly at football games. They show contempt for cruelty and cowardice. They take pride, as your father would know, in your children, and all of these things are expressed openly and so on. But somehow that doesn't count against the charge that somehow we're emotionally repressed. And as I point out in the book, one of the cultural reasons for why it is that men don't cry in public is that, and I don't mean this to sound patronizing, is that somebody has to stay in charge when there's a crisis. Not everybody has the luxury, if you like, of dissolving into emotional, whatever it is. It's one of these things. So, and we do. I mean, men do cry, but we tend to do it in private. We tend to weep in private. Men tend not to cry, but to weep, which is quite a different thing. But that's not something that you want anybody to see you doing.
So what do you think is the, I hate to use the stupid word, agenda, but what do you think, what is the agenda behind pushing this idea of toxic masculinity?
Well, if I were to be very cynical, and why not? Okay, it seems to me that the aim of the very peculiar form of late feminism that we see here isn't the production and maintenance of legal equality between men and women, but an effort, if you like, to as I describe it elsewhere in the chapter on employment, an effort to provide jobs for the girls. In other words, you notice it's they're not really worried too much about, for example, about the women who clean floors, for example, in shopping centers at night when everybody has gone home. That's not the kind of women that they're concerned with. They're concerned with women of their own kind who tend to be highly educated, working in either the government service or public service or the universities. And the effort here seems to be to ensure that these people are employed in preference to men. Okay, so it's jobs for us. That's what they're talking about in the end. I can understand that. That makes sense to me. Otherwise, I simply don't know what they're doing. Because, as I said, the evidence all points in the other direction. Almost all of the women who are leading these things are people who have benefited enormously from the family structure, from their father's support, okay, and are themselves, in most cases, actually married to men and so on. So it's a very peculiar situation. I'm not sure it's capable of rational explication.
Is there a school of feminism that you find to be reasonable? Like that is, and I'm not even trying to be condescending or patronizing here, but that you feel like wrestles with real data and is, I don't know, in some way plugged into reality as you and I experience it, or as most people experience it.
Well, again, first so-called first wave feminism, which contested for the franchise and that sort of thing, and part of second wave feminism seems to me to be quite reasonable. And indeed, there's frankly, there's plenty of work for them to do in many places in the world where women have not actually been accepted as being legally on a par with women. There are many places in the world where this is the case. The irony is, of course, that this is not where the action takes place. It takes place largely in the Western world, where this has been pretty much a given since, I would say, at the latest, the 1980s, and that's putting it probably at the farthest remove. So, I mean, talk about pushing on an open door. This door has been wide open for a long time. I mean, even take, for example, education. So, for example, when I was working in University College Dublin, there were special scholarships for women who wanted to do engineering. There weren't special scholarships for men who wanted to do engineering. Okay. Special programs to encourage them to do this sort of thing. And I was saying, what's the problem? The door is wide open. Just sign up. It's not hard to do. But it's like they need a special encouragement. And you want to know why is this? And I don't understand what the problem was. I've never been able to understand it. Maybe that's because I'm one of these horrible, toxic men. But as I admit at the start of my book, I actually am biased when it comes to women. I'm biased in their favor. I have been. Most men are, in fact. And women are well aware of this and, of course, make extensive use of that fact in their personal and, indeed, in their professional lives.
Let's jump now to what's really on the cover of your book, because you talk about the Me Too movement, which I guess lasted for a little while. And I guess in principle, it's still around, but it was a brief flash of social media activity and commentary that I guess arose in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein allegations. Mm-hmm. What was the background of this? What was the background of this, first of all, before we get into the controversy?
Well, the background, I don't know how to describe it. It occurred in the entertainment industry, which, as we all know, is the repository of morally sound people and doctrine, right? And it transpired. I don't want to be accused of slander here, but it transpired, if you like, this is going to come as a shock to many of your listeners, that in this industry, people with power, producers and the like, use that power to solicit sexual favors from people who could benefit from their patronage. I know this will come as a terrible shock to you, Tom. We've never heard of this before. And so apparently there were some really egregious examples of this. And Harvey Weinstein was accused and apparently has been convicted. I think I'm correct in saying this, of some charges. But the outbreak here, because of course the Twitter went on the march here, and suddenly it turns out that what he and some others may or may not have been doing is something, if you like, that all men apparently are doing. And if that's the case, I don't know when this happened because none of it came my way. Okay. It's not the world in which I live. And I suspect, Tom, it's not the world in which you live. And indeed, most of your listeners live either. And suddenly we were all being charged with, if not actual complicity in carrying out these kind of acts of sexual aggression, being complicit in not talking about it and calling them out, to use the current jargon. And it was quite bizarre. You're right. I mean, it was, in a sense, it had this kind of flash and it sort of spread around the world, like, I suppose, the social equivalent of COVID-19. And now it has subsided. But it had a sort of minor recurrence there a couple of months ago. And my guess is it'll be the kind of thing that will pop up every now and then. But one thing that will happen is that it will live on in memory of many women, for example, as having been a demonstration of, again, the awful truth that this patriarchy exists and its purpose is to oppress and to keep down women. When, of course, it simply turns out that at most we are talking about a certain kind of man in a very small number of professions. And that's the whole truth and nothing but the truth.
I don't know. I'm of two minds on this because I don't think anybody can accuse me of being a softy when it comes to feminism. I think everybody knows where I'm coming from on almost everything. But the thing is, I've just seen with my own eyes situations, not involving sexual harassment, no. But I have seen with my own eyes cases where women are just not taken as seriously as men. So, you know, I used to have to, you know, back in like 2010 or 11 or 12, I would have to go in with my wife to the doctor's office because she had chronic pain, and I would have to be there to make sure she got what she needed. Or otherwise, it sometimes just would not happen. Or there were multiple cases of that. And at first I thought, no, this can't be. And she was not a feminist of any way. She was as traditional as you could possibly be. And I couldn't believe it until I witnessed it myself. And then finally, I had to start going to this, that, or the other thing, or it could be the car repair place or whatever. There was no question in my mind that she was getting treated differently from the way a man would be treated. And I thought, geez, I don't want to believe this. I don't want to believe this. But doggone it, I had to do it for her to get the pain medication she needed.
Yeah. No, I don't disagree with you at all. I mean, without, by the way, in any way trying to justify this, okay, I'm not trying to justify that. A part of that has to do, it's not only women who are treated in that way. For example, doctors secure in their competence, for example, have an attitude very often of disbelief towards their patients. I'll give you an example from my own personal history. There's nothing hanging on this. But many years ago when I was probably in my mid-40s, I went to my doctor, and I rarely go. I have to be sort of marched out the door at the point of a gun to go to the doctor. I'm usually recovering by the time I actually get to see a physician. And I remember seeing a note he was writing, and it was quite clear that he thought I was malingering. And that what I was trying to get was what we call on this side of the Atlantic, a sick note from my employer, so that I would be justified in not turning up for my employment. Little did he know, by the way, that I had to be forcibly restrained from actually going to work, so on. But so there is a sort of, among doctors particularly, there's an attitude of suspicion towards many patients when they have unexplained pains. And I think women actually are treated more harshly in this regard. In other words, they're regarded as being, I don't know, hysterical or have phantom pains or whatever it might be. So yes, there is an element of that. But there's a very big difference between that, okay, and what the Me Too people were talking about. I think those things are actually qualitatively different.
Fair enough. Now, let's talk about something that we've observed in recent years about, let's say you're accused of, well, maybe sexual harassment, but usually something worse. If you're accused of rape, let's say, it's almost like there's a presumption that you must be guilty, because the claim is that it's so infrequent for a woman to make a false charge that therefore, you know, I mean, yeah, once in a while we might be acting unjustly toward an innocent man, but that's very, very rare. So by and large, there's a huge presumption, just on the basis of the statistics, of guilt on the part of the perpetrator. Talk about that, because you have a section on that.
Yeah, no, again, there's a big difference between what is, if you like, a sort of given in the public consciousness and what is actually the case. I'm now talking, if you like, from the top of my head and not looking at the statistics in my book. But for example, in the UK, there's something like 50,000 plus accusations of rape per year. The Crown Prosecution Service in the UK prosecutes something like 3,500 of those. And you might say, well, what's going on there? Well, the Crown Prosecution Service tends to bring a case to trial only if they believe that there is a reasonable chance of conviction. And of those roughly 3,500 cases that are brought to trial, about 40% actually result in a conviction. Now, there's all sorts of things you can say about this. I mean, feminists might say, well, you know, maybe all 57,000 should be prosecuted. But nonetheless, it shows that of the, you know, of the whatever percentage, say 15% that the prosecution service deems to be possibly conviction worthy, less than half actually are judged to be guilty when they're actually brought to trial. So that doesn't suggest that the statistics are actually anything like the case that, you know, that rape is widespread, that we have a rape culture, and that only a tiny fraction of men, if you like, who actually commit rape are convicted. In fact, of the percentage brought to trial, slightly less than half are convicted. So the conviction rate is in fact quite high. But the problem here, Tom, is, I think, goes deeper than this, because what's really significant, if you like, has been the changing definition of rape over the years. And again, just as in the case of feminism, when most people think of feminism, they think of men and women being treated equally by the law, and therefore they're puzzled when you say, I'm not a feminist. When you start talking about rape, what most people have in mind is sort of archetypical notion, if you like, of a woman being dragged into a bushes and sexually assaulted. And that's not what most cases of rape today are about. In fact, those cases account probably for less than 5%. I'm talking, again, quoting off the top of my head here, so I can't vouch for the accuracy of the figures. In most cases, what we're talking about is a sexual encounter between a man and a woman in which there is a disagreement between them as to whether or not there was consent, and the jury has to make a decision. In many cases, the man and the woman know each other. In many cases, you're talking about students. In many cases, it involves drink, so that one or other or both parties are actually drunk or partially drunk, as the case may be. And given that the, you know, criminal trials proceed on the basis that a conviction can only be arrived at if the jury are persuaded beyond a reasonable doubt that the person did in fact commit the crime they're accused of, it's hardly surprising that in these, what I call these messy cases, it's less than clear to the juries that there actually has been a lack of consent on the part of one or both of the partners. In fact, it's almost always the case, a lack of consent on the part of the woman. I've yet to find a case where a woman has been accused of having sexually assaulted a man because he didn't consent. even though the circumstances very often are exactly the same.
Hey, everybody, let's take a quick minute to thank our sponsor, Harry's. They are the official razor of the Tom Woods Show. Are you really a Tom Woods Show listener? If you're not shaving with Harry's the way I am, and you're saving a bundle too, you could save probably enough for 3 deep dish pizza dinners in Chicago or 6 months of your Netflix subscription. Harry's delivers high-quality razor blades as low as $2 each. That's a fraction of the price of the leading brand. Saves you hundreds of dollars over time. I just love the closeness of the shave. I have to shave my neck, keep this beard looking good, and that's the most sensitive area of all, and it is smooth and beautiful every single time. Harry's is a return to the essential, quality, durable blades at a fair price, super convenient, blade refills delivered directly to your door on your schedule with or without a subscription, and you can get blades, hair care, and shower products all on harrys.com. Well, listeners of my show can redeem their Harry's trial set at harrys.com/woods. You'll get a weighted ergonomic handle for a firm grip, 5-blade razor with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, a rich lathering shave gel with aloe to keep your skin hydrated, and a travel blade cover to keep your razor dry and easy to grab on the go. Go to harrys.com/woods to start shaving and saving today. Can we say something about the Judge Kavanaugh hearings? Because you have a short section in here on that, and you quote, I guess, a U.S. senator on television being asked, is Judge Kavanaugh, and by the way, it doesn't matter if I'm a fan of his jurisprudence. That it doesn't even matter. What does that matter? But they were asking a senator, is he entitled to the presumption of innocence that we normally afford people accused of things like this? And you could not get a straight answer out of that. I forget which senator it was. It was in your book.
Yeah, it was Senator Mazie Hirono from Hawaii.
Okay.
Yeah, no, that's quite extraordinary. And of course, you had the mantra which has been chanted: "Believe women." And you know, as the comedian Bill Burr, one of your says, "What, believe all of them? I'll give you 87%, but what about the 30% that keys your car, okay, and boils your pet, okay?" And in fact, believe all of them—that's incoherent because in fact they contradict one another, so that doesn't make any sense. And I noticed, by the way, when Joe Biden, who's now obviously going to be the Democratic candidate for president, when he was accused of some sexual misdemeanor, I'm not convicting him, by the way, I'm not making any judgment on this, suddenly the mantra of believe women suddenly became, well, we didn't quite mean believe them, we meant what they said should be taken seriously. Well, yes, that's true. Okay, but that wasn't quite what was being said when Brett Kavanaugh was being looked at.
Oh, that's right. In fact, when they tried to change it at that point, because they realized, well, this is going to hurt Biden if we say believe all women, they immediately backtracked and said, well, of course we don't mean believe all women. But so what people did on Twitter was they just went back and retweeted what these people had said. And clearly that is what they said. We all know it's what they said. They know it's what they said. Everybody involved knows that that's what they said.
Yeah. You know, that's quite extraordinary. And, it was really baffling. And, I mean, there are other things we could talk about here. One is, if you like, the pernicious nature of something like Twitter, which I regard as the modern equivalent of the sort of villagers with their torches, okay, ever ready to come out and demonstrate against the villain or whatever it might be. And it's quite extraordinary, but it's very, very powerful. And we had extraordinary scenes. I mean, looking at them from across the Atlantic on this side of it, I mean, it was staggering to see what took place in Washington with senators being chased down corridors and harassed and screamed at, okay, because they weren't prepared to convict or to make their decision on the suitability of a candidate for the Supreme Court simply on the basis of an accusation from whatever it was 20, 30 years ago without corroborating evidence and all the sort of it. We know all the details here. But apparently the idea of believe women was all that needed to be done. And of course, as we've just pointed out, this turned out to be not quite what they said. Because when it was to be used against them, they suddenly realized, oops, this is a sword, and a sword cuts innocent and guilty alike.
Yeah. You would think that on something like violence against women, this should be non-ideological, and everybody agrees on it. And the thing is, it is non-ideological, and everybody agrees on it. Mm-hmm. But yet we live in alternate realities. So we live in a reality in which, in my version of reality, if somebody is accused of rape, his life is over and society condemns him. In their reality, we live in a, quote, rape culture. Yes. I don't even know what that could possibly mean, but that is clearly false.
The rape culture, it's a baffling. It really is baffling. I mean, look, many people who put this line forward about rape culture will say, well, you know, it's they'll say, look, there's no reason for a woman to lie about these things. And I go, well, yes, there is. There are many reasons. And the reason for that is because, I hate to say it, I think women are human beings like anybody else. Okay, men lie and women lie. Men are fearful of consequences of their actions. Women are fearful of consequences of their actions for exactly the same reasons that men will lie. Women can lie or tell the truth or exaggerate or can forget or misinterpret or do all of these things. In fact, I gave a talk on the subject recently at a conference here in Ireland, and the audience was primarily women. And I was being slightly sardonic, as is my wont. And I said, of course, women are perfect beings and we are privileged to live among them. They never lie, they never cheat, they never steal, they never exaggerate, they're never guilty of any wrongdoing whatsoever. And all the women in the audience laughed. They all laughed. Okay. I thought they would storm the stage and kill me, but they all just laughed, which is what a reasonable woman would do, because that's, of course, being a human being means we have all of these particular faults. So yeah, there are reasons why somebody would do this. And by the way, in many cases where a person accused of rape, when it does go to trial and they're not convicted, it doesn't mean that the jury didn't think that there was something to the complaint, but they didn't think that the issues were clear enough so that you could actually convict. And that's not unreasonable when you think of what the consequences are for a man. If he's convicted of rape, his life is effectively over. He'll never be employed again. He will probably lose his marriage, lose his job, and so on. And by the way, in the UK, I don't know what it's like in the USA, I actually didn't check this out, but in the UK, where if you're accused, your name is in the public realm from the moment you're accused. So that, for example, you know, the whole thing can, there was a case in Northern Ireland where some rugby players were accused of rape. And the trial and so on, the whole thing took about 18 months and their names were in the paper, there were photographs, there was TV footage and so on. And they were actually acquitted, okay, and then fired from their jobs. Quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
Quite extraordinary. I mean, nobody could make a case, by the way, for the moral probity of these people and so on, or indeed of the victim if it came to that. I mean, none of them are behaving in what I think would be a reasonably moral way. But if we're all going to be convicted criminally on the grounds of our immorality, then we're all seriously in trouble. Yeah, quite extraordinary.
Yeah, it is. Now, you'd like to say there's a backlash, but I don't know. I think it's more that it's hard to know, right? It's hard to know how many people go along with stuff like this because it's socially dominant and they don't know what else to do, and how many people are really the hardcore ideological drivers of this. There are a lot of resistors of it, and I don't mean the lame resisting of Trump, because that generally that means they want even more government power. Some resistance those people are. But generally, I do see some people resisting this kind of misinformation and propaganda and the intimidation of this whole sort of program. But it's hard to do that because all of society is against you.
That's right. No, that is correct. And I mean, again, what will happen is you will be accused of being a closet. A defender of rape, for example, or indeed it may even be suggested that you are a closet rapist or abuser yourself. It is such a distasteful area to be involved in that there's a sort of air of contamination that comes off it, even in talking about it. And most normal human beings don't want to spend their time thinking about this, and whatever they think in private, they're not prepared, if you like, to become part of a mob demonstrating in the other direction. So what happens is that a very small number of very prominent people who have very large followings in Twitter and social media can actually call and dominate the agenda in this area. And of course, we get the impression, those of us who, you know, who read newspapers and watch TV and so on, get the impression that there is much more of this and it's much more widespread than it actually is. I suspect the reality is that most human beings are getting on with their jobs, with their families, with their children, and with their careers and doing whatever it is they have to do and are not worrying about this at all, except when it happens to them. Now, one of the things that does seem to be happening, and one of the things I point out in the book, is that there is a backlash, not an overt backlash, but a sort of silent, as it were, backlash, where men, realizing the dangers that they are in associating with women in anything but the sort of the most public arenas, are to some extent drawing back. You know, so you get the kind of Penn strategy where men, for strategic reasons, will not want to be alone with a woman in a room discussing, for example, a business deal or mentorship. And women are now beginning to complain that men are, you know, not associating with them in work, except insofar as it's absolutely necessary for them to do so. And this is not good, by the way. It's not good for men, and it's not good for women either, right? And of course, it will affect not just the guilty women, as it were, those people who are guilty of exaggerating these things, but in fact, many ordinary, decent women who are trying to make their way in the world and deserve not to be treated differentially from men.
Well, I want to obviously recommend your book because it's not only does it have a lot of great information, but it's got that great Casey wit throughout that keeps you wanting to turn those pages. So it's After Me Too, Feminism, Patriarchy, Toxic Masculinity, and Sundry Cultural Delights. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/1714. Professor Casey, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Tom.
All right, folks, some really great, fun episodes coming up for you this week, and I'll tell you about them in just a minute. But for now, I want to tell you about yet another website created by a Tom Woods Show listener, and that is terralifeyoga.com. That's TerraLifeYoga.com. Terra Life Yoga helps you find your center by means of its online yoga community that is supportive and caring for people of all levels. No experience needed. They feature live classes via Zoom, unlike YouTube classes, so they build a community and enhance your practice. Come to the class a few minutes early, stay a few minutes after to chat if you wish. Members-only videos frequently target specific body areas such as core and hips and shoulders, and you can practice on your own schedule. Monthly memberships are now half price for your first month and 50% off classes during this month, August 2020, if you use, what else, promo code WOODS. So the website, terralifeyoga.com. Go check that out. We'll link to that also at tomwoods.com/1714. And remember, of course, if you would like publicity for your website or blog, before you start those things, check out tomwoods.com/publicity. If you get your hosting through my link, I'll give you some nice publicity, some great targeted traffic, plus a bunch of other really, really helpful bonuses that will give you an unfair advantage out of the gate. So tomwoods.com/publicity is how to get these free bonuses that will boost you. Coming up this week, we've got Anthony Samaroff, our old friend, the author of the book on universal basic income, For and Against. But he's got a rather different topic to discuss with us, and it's something, well, let's just say a lot of libertarians could probably stand to learn about. So we'll talk to him. Michael Malice coming back in the middle of the week, and we're going to talk about something Pete Canonas brought up about Michael some time ago in my AMA with him, about whether it makes sense for us to be optimistic or not, looking to the future, and whether we should assess our present situation as good or bad. And Michael is very insistent on looking at the recent past and the somewhat distant past and comparing it from a bird's eye point of view and saying that overall, we are obviously much better off in very significant ways, even if there are indeed very great challenges as well. So we're going to kind of hash that out because I'm feeling kind of down in the dumps these days. So we're going to hash out the optimism, pessimism thing. Then let's see. Oh, John Zmirak's come back. We're going to talk about guns, but in a way you've never heard before. And then finally, I've got some tips at the end of this week for not just for persuasion, but for public speaking in general. And some of this will have to do with libertarianism and some just are general tips that I've picked up that are my own from my 25-year career as a public speaker. So a lot of great stuff. Make sure you subscribe to the show, tomwoods.com/apple, so you get all these episodes delivered seamlessly to your device, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.